It's now my pleasure to invite Brother Mark to deliver our much-needed words of exhortation.
Thanks, Rylan. Good morning, everyone. You'll have to forgive me this morning. I've been sick this past week. I'm hoping it's not like the sickness that Jeremy's been experiencing. I think I'm better. Well enough to be here, but I'm a little concerned about my voice lasting till the end of the exhortation this morning. So maybe I'll start by having a drink of water. Our reading from Mark's Gospel this morning comes at what I think is a bit of a turning point in Jesus' ministry. And although there were still large crowds following him and many that were still eager to hear him, to listen to him, to see the miracles that were being performed, there was also, of course, a growing opposition to his teaching and the claims that he was making. The crowd that was gathered at the shore at the beginning of Mark chapter 4, which we just read, actually made up a very diverse group of people with varying opinions of him. They're identified in chapter 3. Mark tells us in chapter 3 that there was a large crowd from Galilee, probably locals, many people from Judea, Jerusalem, Idumea, from the regions across Jordan, and from Tyre and Sidon. And likely his family, they're mentioned in chapter 3, and those closest to him, his disciples, who left everything to follow him. And the Jewish leaders, who were not only keeping a close eye on him, but were already planning to kill him. So there were those who believed in him, those who needed healing, those who were curious, and those who wanted him dead. Jesus was sowing the seed to this broad audience. And of course, unfortunately, in the end, not all of them would accept his teaching. And I think that's a big reason why the parables were becoming more of a basis for his teaching. We certainly see that in the reading from Mark this morning, and it's something that the disciples noticed as well. In the parallel account in Matthew, the disciples asked Jesus, "Why do you speak to the people in parables?" Now, on the surface, parables are a good way of teaching. They're really object lessons, aren't they? And the objects presented in parables from everyday life help us to relate to and remember the lesson. But of course, they're only truly effective if the lessons are remembered and taken to heart, not if they're ignored or resisted. And the parables of Jesus were, I think, also intended to create that distinction, the distinction between those who took the lessons to heart and those who resisted. When the disciples asked Jesus, "Why do you speak to the people in parables?" his response in Matthew was, "Because it is given to you to understand the mysteries of the kingdom, but to them it is not given." And I think this served two purposes, to enlighten those who accepted his teaching and to confuse those who resisted it. Because the message was only understood by those who humbly accepted the word and allowed it to influence and define their lives. On the other hand, those who were opposed to Jesus, who he describes as being dull of hearing, automatically rejected what he was teaching. So they missed the point, because the parables challenge us to think, don't they? They challenge us to see the underlying meaning. So in this crowd that gathered to hear him that day, there were those who were gladly accepting his teaching. There were those who were opposed to it or hard to it, and I believe everyone in between. And it was to all of them that Jesus began to teach in parables, beginning fittingly, I think, in this chapter with the parable of the sower. So let's read that parable once again. Mark chapter 4, and we'll read verses 3 to 9. Listen, a farmer went out to sow the seed. As he was scattering the seed, some fell along the path, and the birds came and ate it up. Some fell on rocky ground, rocky places where it did not have much soil. It sprang up quickly because the soil was shallow. But when the sun came up, the plants were scorched. They withered because they had no root. Other seed fell among thorns, which grew up and choked the plants so that they did not bear grain. Still other seed fell on good soil. It came up, grew, and produced a crop, multiplying 30, 60, or even 100 times. Then Jesus said, "He who has ears to hear, let him hear." Now, of course, there are three key elements in this parable: the seed, the ground, and the external influences that came along. And there are four different kinds of ground. And we read here that when Jesus was alone with the disciples and those closest to them, he explained the meaning of the parable. In verse 14, he says, "The sower sows the word." In the immediate context, this would be Jesus, and the seed is the word of God. And the seed that Jesus was sowing was spread on different kinds of ground, which represent, of course, different kinds of people. So the seed wasn't sown selectively. It was available for everyone. That was consistent. The variability was the ground. So I think the lesson in the parable is really in the ground, in the soil, in how the seed is received by the soil. Does it germinate? Does it set roots? Does it grow? Does it thrive? Does it produce a crop? Because that's the purpose of sowing the seed, isn't it? That's the desired outcome, that the seed in the end is fruitful. So I think the focus of the lesson, as Jesus explains it, is in the ground. Jesus is telling us that people can receive or respond to the word differently. And the reception and response, I think, is tied to the condition of our hearts. In the parable, people are identified with four different kinds of ground. Hard ground, where the seed never germinates. Rocky ground, where the seed germinates but quickly withers away. Thorny ground, where the seed germinates but is choked out and in the end doesn't produce. And good ground, where the seed germinates, grows, and it's fruitful. So I'd like to look at those different kinds of ground a little bit more. The first type of ground, or person, is identified in verse 15 as Jesus is explaining the parable, where Mark says, "Some people are like seed along the path where the word is sown. As soon as they hear it, Satan comes and takes away the word that was sown in them." So some seed falls on the path, a hard, compacted surface, it's been walked on over and over again, very hard. There's no elements present that are conducive to germination, let alone growth or production. So the seed just sits on the surface and is eventually snatched away. And this represents the heart that has been hardened, a stubborn heart that isn't receptive to hearing and understanding the word. I think the Jewish leaders were in that category. They didn't want to listen to him, and I think the reason was because that they would have to admit that they were wrong. So they were being very stubborn, and that hardness robbed them of the ability to understand and accept what Jesus was teaching. And I think on another level, this comes down to sin taking over the heart. When it does, we become hardened. In Hebrews chapter 3, verses 12 and 13, it says, "See to it that none of you has a sinful, unbelieving heart that turns away from the living God. Encourage one another so that none of you be hardened by sin's deceitfulness. This ground, this hard ground, typifies the world where pride, self-interest, and opposition to God and what is true hardens the heart. When the seed is sown on that kind of ground, it's immediately ignored or quickly snatched away. This kind of heart does not even meet the basic requirements for germination. The second type of soil at least allows for germination, verses 16 and 17. Others, like seed on rocky places, hear the word and at once receive it with joy. But since they have no root, they only last a short time. When trouble or persecution comes because of the word, they quickly fall away. So on this ground, there isn't, well, there is enough soil to allow for germination and even that quick flush of growth, that initial growth. But because the ground is shallow, or the soil shallow, or because it's very rocky, growth is not sustainable. There isn't enough soil to allow the roots to spread and receive the moisture and nutrients that allows the plant to grow and thrive and produce. So when trouble comes or persecution comes, of course, the seedling that sprouted wilts. Or, as Matthew has, when the sun comes up, when heat is a factor, the plant is scorched. You know, I see this on the job occasionally as a landscaper. You know, you'll meet with a customer who's maybe building a new house, and they want to have a nice, brand new lawn. And they usually describe it as wanting the nicest lawn on the street. They want everyone to see it. They want to be the envy of the neighborhood. And eventually the discussion turns to how much soil is required to achieve this result. And usually at this stage, the site is graded out very rough. It might even be rocky ground. And, you know, there's only an allowance there for adding a few inches of soil because a lot of the hard elements are in place. It might be curbs, sidewalks, and driveways and so on. And I tell them that the minimum requirement for lawns should be 6 inches. But if you're over rough, rocky ground, it should be more. It should be 8 or 9 inches. And then, of course, what do they ask? What's the cost? How much is that going to cost? And it's not a matter of just adding more soil. You also have to remove those rocks to allow in the profile for that extra depth of soil to achieve the results that they want. So you're not just adding more soil. You're removing, hauling, and dumping some of that excess material. And of course, when they learn how much it will cost, they say, but if we just, you know, leave it like this and add a few inches, it'll be okay, won't it? They want the result, but they're not really prepared to pay the cost. You know, at that point, I think maybe I should just start asking, are you familiar with the parable of the sower? Maybe they will be, maybe they won't be, but, you know, and if the job proceeds, of course, without enough soil, even after doing the best job that you can, you, of course, will get that call from the customer saying that the lawn is not performing to their satisfaction, and they wonder if there's anything that that we can do about it. So, yeah, in the end, the desired outcome isn't achieved because the cost or the effort was too great. So the seed, in that case, is sown on ground that won't be completely productive. It'll be unsatisfactory. So I think this represents the person who receives the word with joy. When the heat is applied, when summer comes, when trials or troubles come because there is no depth to them, their conviction fades. They stumble and maybe even give up. The third type of ground or type of person is the thorny ground, verses 18 and 19. Still others, like seed sown among thorns, hear the word, but the worries of this life, the deceitfulness of wealth, and the desires for other things come in and choke the word, making it unfruitful. So in this case, the seed or the word is sown on ground where thorns or weeds are already growing. And the seed on this ground does germinate. It grows. But of course, it can't compete with the thorns, with the weeds, or the worries of this life, the desires of the world. And they choke the life out of the plant. The problem, of course, is that thorns and good seed shouldn't be cultivated together. It doesn't work. And I think it's really the equivalent maybe of being double-minded. You know, someone who wants what the seed provides. They see the value in it. They see the reward. But maybe they also want what the world has to offer at the same time. They want both. They even hear warnings in the word about wealth or worldly desires, the warnings about serving two masters. You know, maybe they aren't really seeking the kingdom first. They want it, but they're also seeking the kingdom of the world. There's that duplicity in effect that, of course, isn't productive. It's a life lived with nothing to show for it, even though there was enough good soil to sustain a healthy, fruitful life. And then there's the good ground, representing the last condition of the heart Jesus was identifying. Verse 20. Others, like seed sown on good soil, hear the word, accept it, and produce a crop 30, 60, or even 100 times what was sowing. So this is the person, of course, who hears the word, accepts it, manifests its characteristics, and is fruitful, produces a crop. And that's because the seed is grown in good soil that's productive, unlike the other soils. And I think this soil represents the person who will inherit the reward in the end. The other soils where the seed isn't fruitful were identified as hard, rocky, shallow, and even divided in focus. Soils that represent the hard, stubborn heart that isn't receptive to the word, the heart that doesn't have the conviction to withstand the troubles of life when the heat is applied, and the heart that is conflicted or overcome by the world. The good soil, though, is different. What makes it good? Well, it isn't hard. It's open. It's receptive. It accepts the word and allows it to take root so that it can't be snatched away. It's not rocky or shallow. It's a soil that has depth. It provides an environment that produces a healthy plant that can withstand the heat of the day. And it's a soil that is free of competing ambitions, desires, and pursuits. The composition of the good soil makes it suitable for healthy and productive plants. And it represents who we have to be. As a landscaper, I'll bring up another analogy, I guess. We're faced with meeting certain soil specifications on commercial projects. It's actually part of the contractual obligation we have with customers or the contractors. There are specifications that are written by engineers or landscape architects that have to be met. They aren't vague. They're actually very detailed, even scientific. The idea is that the customer receives good soil on their site that will be suitable for growing healthy plants. That protection is put in place for the customer, and we have to follow those specifications to ensure that the desired result is achieved. And one of the specifications includes details like having adequate soil depth. There's minimum depths required for different kinds of plants. For grass, it's typically 8 or 9 inches. For shrubs, it could be 18 to 24 inches. And for some large boulevard trees, the municipal specification is that there can be up to 20 cubic yards of soil available for one single tree. And so the base materials on site have to be excavated to accommodate these soil depths, and then those soil depths are inspected and approved before any soil is brought to the site. And the soil that's brought to the site also has to undergo a compositional and nutritional analysis before it is accepted. Most soils are actually made up of gravel, sand, clay, silt, and organic material. And those parts, those elements, have to be in correct balance. Soil screen, so any rocks over half an inch are removed. That can be in the specification. If there's too much sand, too great a percentage of sand in the soil, it'll dry out. The soil profile will dry out too quickly, and the plants will suffer because of it. If there's too much clay or silt in the soil, the soil might hold too much moisture, which isn't good for the roots. And of course, when clay soils dry out, they become very hard, like that, like the pathway. Same with organic material. Some plants like to grow in a lot of organic material. Some don't. If the soil is nutritionally deficient, nutrients can be added. If the pH is out of balance, that can be corrected. And then once the soil is mixed with the best intentions in the result, a sample's taken, it's sent off to a lab for analysis. And if the soil meets the specifications, it's accepted and can be brought to the job site. All this is done to ensure that the customer receives good soil suitable for growing healthy plants. Can be a bit of a challenge at times, actually, to be honest. And you know, I think we need to analyze our lives. Are we representative of that good soil? Or do we need to make adjustments in its composition? You know, there were many people who listened to Jesus that day as he sowed the seed. Many different types of people. Most of them likely represented in the parable. But where do we fit? What kind of soil are we? You know, it's probably easy for us to eliminate the first type of ground. We've been receptive to the word. It's growing. It's healthy. We're being productive. We're the good soil. We're fruitful. It's probably easy to categorize ourselves that way. But I think I might ignore the fact that those other influences are still present. Weeds often grow when we don't expect them. And any gardener knows that weeds are typically more dominant than the crop that we want to bring to maturity. Those weeds, those thistles, have to be removed. If they're not, anything good can be choked out. We're receptive to the word, but can we allow our hearts to harden at times, to stubbornly ignore what the word is telling us? Are we established on a sure foundation with adequate depth and conviction to ensure that when the heat is applied, we can overcome? The parable shows that the seed doesn't achieve the same results and tells us why. So in reality, the seed tests the soil to see if it reveals the character suitable for God's purpose. It identifies who we are, what kind of soil we are. If we have an open heart to receive the word, if we have the depth of conviction, if our life is free of the competing influences of the world, we'll be fruitful. And we'll produce a crop that is 30, 60, 100 times what has been sown. And hear those welcome words. Well done, good and faithful servant.